Welcome back to the second half of the Making Waves program. Now it's time for some announcements. On Friday, December 31st, from 10 p.m. to 3 a.m., Trashcan Lid Productions will host an 80s party at their new studios in the Elliott Business Park, Suite 11, on Route 236 in Elliott, Maine, to benefit WSCA-LP 106.1. For more information, call 603-502-5886. On Sunday, January 2nd, 2005, from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., there will be a meditation marathon at the Aryaloka Buddhist Center in Newmarket, New Hampshire. This is a pledge or donation event. See www.aryaloka.org or call 659-5456 for full details. On Tuesday, January 4th, 2005, at 7 p.m., there will be an event sponsored by Seacoast Peace Response. New Hampshire filmmaker Tom Jackson will premiere his brand new film, Worlds Apart, 9/11 First Responders Against War, at the U Church, 292 State Street in Portsmouth. Over 300 first responders gave their lives in attempts to save lives at Ground Zero in New York City. For many who survived, the horror of 9/11 and the days after continue to affect them every single day. In New York City, a group of first responders have called for nonviolent responses to the attacks. It is their belief that violence will only breed more violence and the cycle will go on and on. Worlds Apart focuses on these particular heroes of 9/11 and their lives since that tragic day. The documentary features footage from a peacemaking delegation that brought 9/11 EMT Megan Bartlett and Joe Public Films producer Tom Jackson to Afghanistan in May 2004. They met with Afghan first responders in an attempt to establish ties of friendship and to see if Afghan rescue workers were really so different than those in New York City. For more information, contact Amy at 750-7506. Friday, January 7th, at 6:30 p.m., there will be a planning meeting of Seacoast Peace Response at the Carnan House, 206 Court Street, behind the UU Church, in Portsmouth. For more information, contact David at 749-9159. On Saturday, January 8th, from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., there will be a nonviolence training offered in Portsmouth before the counter-inaugural in Washington, D.C. Led by Amy Antonucci of Seacoast Peace Response and Sean Donahue, formerly of New Hampshire Peace Action. This nonviolence training mixes information, discussion, exercises, and role plays to learn about and explore what nonviolent activism is and how it's used, the role of affinity groups, consensus decision-making, legal issues, and more. This training is an important way to prepare for an action or to improve effectiveness and thoughtfulness as an activist. There are also life skills that are useful in many other situations. For more information and to register, please contact Amy, AMYLA, number 44, at juno.com or 750-7506. On Thursday, January 20th, there will be a national anti-war protest in Washington, D.C., organized by International Answer and regional peace groups. New Hampshire Peace Action is sponsoring buses from Portsmouth and Concord, New Hampshire, to the counter-inaugural anti-war protest and rally in Washington, D.C. Jamila El Shafai will be organizing protesters from southern Maine and southeastern New Hampshire. For more information on the bus from Portsmouth, email Jamila at jamilla at wellinformed.org, that's wellinformed.org, or call during the day 207-439-5800.
Another news piece from Reuters. In New York, this past week, President Bush was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year for 2004. Time chose Bush, quote, for sticking to his guns, literally and figuratively, for reshaping the rules of politics to fit his 10-gallon hat leadership style, and for persuading a majority of voters this time around that he deserved to be in the White House for another 4 years, end quote, Jim Kelly wrote in the magazine. Bush was also Time's choice to appear on the cover in 2000 after winning the presidential election despite losing the popular vote. His father, President George H.W. Bush, was named Man of the Year in 1990 for what Time called his mastery of foreign policy and his wavering domestic record. Last year, the magazine picked the American Soldier. Kelly said he and his staff debated giving the award to others, including Karl Rove, the president's influential political advisor, and filmmakers Michael Moore and Mel Gibson. The winner must be the person or persons who most affected the news in our lives, for good or for ill, and embodied what was most important about the year, for better or for worse, he said. American aviator Charles Lindbergh was Time's first Man of the Year in 1927. Some selections have been notoriously unpopular, such as Adolf Hitler in 1938, Joseph Stalin in 1939 and 1942, and Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979. For those of you who gave people Christmas presents of Time magazine this year, you might want to reconsider for next year. Last Saturday, activists from Seacoast Peace Response came together to pass out holiday cards containing information about the war on Iraq. They visited area malls and estimate having given out at least 800 of the flyers. If you'd like to carry on with this effort, go to NHPeaceAction.org. That's NHPeaceAction.org to download the card to pass out yourself. Along with the information, the card also gives suggestions for action on the back. I'm going to read you this card. The front says Peace on Earth, has a lovely drawing of a dove, and this quote, "Peace is our work. To everyone, Christians, believers, and men and women of goodwill, I say, do not be afraid to take a chance on peace, to teach peace. Peace will be the last word of history." By Pope John Paul II. The inside is entitled War in Iraq, and it brings us this information. For each hour you spend shopping, the U.S. government spends $5.6 million on the ongoing war and occupation of Iraq. New Hampshire taxpayers have now spent $680 million in the Iraq war and occupation. Had our spending priorities been different, New Hampshire could now have all of the following: 6,071 new affordable housing units, 56 new elementary schools, 62,248 more people receiving health care, 78,531 more college students receiving scholarships, 247,230 more children receiving health care, and 16,573 additional public safety officers. Additional human costs of the Iraq war and occupation. More than 1,200 dead U.S. soldiers will never come home for the holidays. At least 9,765 U.S. soldiers have been wounded in Iraq. What are the people of Iraq getting for the holidays? Over 100,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed, with countless others wounded, orphaned, or homeless. Malnutrition among the youngest children in Iraq has nearly doubled since the U.S.-led invasion. 60% of rural residents and 20% of urban residents do not have access to clean water. 6.5 million Iraqis, 26% of the total population, are dependent on food rations. One in four Iraqi families has suffered a death as a direct result of U.S.-led invasion and occupation. 14 new permanent U.S. military bases are being built on Iraqi soil. Exposure to depleted uranium from U.S. weapons, bombardment with phosphorus and cluster bombs. All of this information is referenced in the handout. You can find it also on the website.
Lands of milk and
Christmas wish list. The self-described Iraqi girl blogger shares her wish list on the Baghdad Burning blog. Okay, what is the typical Iraqi Christmas wish list? I don't list peace, security, and freedom. Christmas miracles are exclusive to Charles Dickens. Let's see. 1. 20 liters of gasoline. 2. A cylinder of gas for cooking. 3. Kerosene for the heaters. 4. Those expensive blast-proof windows. 5. Landmine detectors. 6. Running water. 7. Thuraya satellite telephones. The mobile phone service are really, really bad as of late. 8. Portable diesel generators for the whole family to enjoy. 9. Coleman rechargeable flashlight with extra batteries. You can never go wrong with a fancy flashlight. And 10. Scented candles. It shows you care, but you're also practical. When Santa delivers, please make sure he is wearing a bulletproof vest and helmet. He should also politely ring the doorbell or knock, as a more subtle entry might bring him face to face with an AK-47. With the current fuel shortage, reindeer and a sleigh are highly practical, but Rudolph should be left behind, as the flashing red nose might create a bomb scare. We're all a little jumpy lately. That was from riverbendblog.blogspot.com.
Open your hearts to the paradise, to the peace of the heavenly angels. Take away that woeful shadow dancing on your wall. Take to the skies of peace, oh friends of peace of the one great spirit. Get ready for my bugle call of peace. I can hear the bugle sounding, roaming round my land, my city and my town. Peace, peace, peace. I can hear the voices ringing louder while my bugle calls for peace.
Thick war clouds will throw their shadows, darkening the world around you. But in my life of peace, your dark illusions fall. Think and pray along the way. Embrace the ones around you. Get ready for my bugle call of peace.
Peace, I can hear the bugle sounding,
calls for peace. If these war storms fill your heart with a thousand kinds of worry, keep to my road of peace, and you never have to fear. Keep in the sun and look around in the face of peace and plenty. Get ready for my bugle call of peace. I'll clear my house of the weeds of fear and turn to the friends around me with my smile of peace. I'll greet you one and all. I'll work out, fight, I'll dance and sing a piece of the youthful spirit. Get ready for my bugle call of peace. Peace, 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 I can hear the bugle sounding, roaming around my land, my city and my town. Peace, 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 I can hear the voices ringing louder while my bugle calls for peace. Get ready for my bugle call of peace.
That was Eliza Gilkison with Peace Call. Previously, we heard her do Milk and Honey. This day also marks some other events in history. On December 25th in 1978, four Santa Clauses were arrested climbing a fence at Pilgrim Nuclear Plant in Plymouth, Mass. In 1990, mass demonstrations in India to protest dam building and flooding of thousands of farms happened. The project is eventually significantly reduced, proving that the IMF and World Bank don't always succeed in keeping the rabble in line. Other birthdays. In 1875, on December 25th, Jesse Wallace Huen, founder of the War Resisters League, was born. And on December 24th, Christmas Eve, 1943, Tarja Halonen, Finland's first woman president, was born. Although we can't attest to the correct pronunciation of her name, we want to bring you this information on Tarja, who is a fascinating figure. Tarja Halonen, the 11th president of Finland and the first woman to hold her country's highest position, was inaugurated for a six-year term on the 1st of March in 2000. A former foreign minister and a social democrat, she defeated the non-socialist candidate, former Prime Minister Esko Aho, in the second round of the popular vote. A member of parliament since 1979, she was also the first woman to become a foreign minister. Tarja Halonen has a reputation as an independent spirit who goes her own way. As an unmarried mother, she raised and educated her daughter Anna, who is now reading international politics in England. Her interest in the affairs of society not only led her into politics, but also brought her important positions in numerous civic organizations. Not even when she was running for the presidency did she falter on points of principle concerning her personal life, even though it was widely believed that a woman who had relinquished her membership of the church and was living in a non-marital cohabitation would scare off voters. But even before the election, opinion polls indicated that a majority of people would be prepared to accept her as their leader. The relationship between the head of state and her partner did cause a minor headache where protocol was concerned. At official functions, however, Pentti Arajärvi, a civil servant at parliament, was received naturally in the same way that a spouse would have been. A few months after election, the two married in a simple and very private ceremony. Before going into politics, She held several jobs, including one as a lawyer with the country's biggest trade union confederation. She has held ministerial office longer than any other Finnish woman, and before taking over at the foreign ministry, held the social affairs and justice portfolios. In that latter post, she was again the first woman. As a leader, Tarja Halonen has been described as generous and possessing a sense of humor, but also as demanding and exact. Indeed, she describes herself as demanding. "If you do something, do it properly," she says. Anecdotes about her colorful language are still told in the quarters of the foreign ministry, where people are accustomed to a more formal way of life. President Halonen avoids unnecessary ostentation, and there is no doubt that this will have an effect on life at the presidential palace. The nation had a taste of the new style during the inauguration ceremonies. Having raised her glass in a toast with Speaker of Parliament, the new president was horrified at the stiffness of the people all around her. "Couldn't we get into a somewhat looser formation?" she asked. During the election campaign, she highlighted her most important values: democracy, a welfare society, and the rule of law. In 1914, on Christmas Day, just after midnight, a majority of German troops engaged in World War I called a ceasefire and commenced to sing Christmas carols. They approached the armies of the other side, and here is a song called "Christmas in the Trenches" by Charlie King and Karen Brando telling that story.
Oh, my name is Francis Tolliver. I come from Liverpool. 4 years ago, the war was waiting for me after school. To Belgium and to Flanders, to Germany to hear, I fought for king and country I loved dear. 'Twas Christmas in the trenches, where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were still, no Christmas song was sung. Our families back in England were toasting us that day, their brave and glorious lads so far away. I was lying with my messmate on the cold and rocky ground, when across the lines of battle came a most peculiar sound. Says I, "Now listen up, me boys, each soldier strained to hear, as one young German voice sang out so clear. He's singing bloody well, you know," my messmate says to me. Soon one by one each German voice joined in harmony. Cannons rested silent, the gas clouds rolled no more, as Christmas brought us respite from the war. As soon as he was finished, and a reverent pause was spent, "God rest ye merry gentlemen," struck up our lads from Kent. The next they sang was "Stealy Night, 'Tis Silent Night," says I. And in two tongues one song filled up that sky. "There's someone coming towards us," the frontline sentry cried. All sights were fixed on one lone figure trudging from their side. His truce flag, like the Christmas star, shone on that plain so bright, as he bravely strode unarmed into the night. Then one by one on either side stepped into no man's land, with neither gun nor bayonet we met there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy, and we wished each other well, and in a flare-lit soccer game we gave 'em hell. We traded chocolates, cigarettes, photographs from home. Sons and fathers far away from families of our own. Young Sanders played his squeeze box and they had a violin. This curious and unlikely band of men. Soon daylight stole upon us. France was France once more. With sad farewells we each began to settle back to war. But the question haunted every heart that lived that wondrous night. Whose family have I fixed within my sight? 'Twas Christmas in the trenches where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were warmed as songs of peace were sung. For the walls they'd placed between us to exact the work of war had crumbled and were gone forevermore. My name is Francis Tolliver. In Liverpool I dwell. Each Christmas comes since World War I, I've learned its lessons well. That the ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame. And on each end of the rifle, we're the same.
This is Making Waves on WSCA 106.1 FM. That was Christmas in the Trenches by Charlie King and Karen Brandaugh. We're now going to bring you some information and food for thought about other holidays celebrated at this time of year. Kwanzaa is a unique African-American celebration with focus on the traditional African values of family, community responsibility, commerce, and self-improvement. Kwanzaa is neither political nor religious, and despite some misconceptions, is not a substitute for Christmas. It is simply a time of reaffirming African-American people, their ancestors, and culture. Kwanzaa, which means first fruits of the harvest in the African language Kiswahili, has gained tremendous acceptance since its founding in 1966 by Dr. Malana Karenga. Kwanzaa has come to be observed by more than 18 million people worldwide, as reported by the New York Times. When establishing Kwanzaa in 1966, Dr. Karenga included an additional A to the end of the spelling to reflect the difference between the African-American celebration, Kwanzaa, and the motherland spelling, Kwanzaa, with one A. Kwanzaa is based on seven guiding principles, one for each day of the observance, and is celebrated from December 26 to January 1. This past Tuesday, December 21, was the winter solstice. In honor of that very short, but for so long celebrated day, we give you this information from the Religious Tolerance website, which is religioustolerance.org. Religious people worldwide observe many seasonal days of celebration during the month of December. Most are religious holy days and are linked in some way to the winter solstice. On that night, the daytime hours are at a minimum in the northern hemisphere and nighttime is at a maximum. Origins of solstice celebration. In prehistoric times, winter was a very difficult time for Aboriginal people in the northern latitudes. The growing season had ended, and the tribe had to live off of stored food and whatever animals they could catch. After the winter solstice, they would have reason to celebrate as they saw the sun rising and strengthening once more. Although many months of cold weather remained before spring, they took heart that the return of the warm season was inevitable. The concept of birth and or death and rebirth became associated with the winter solstice. Aboriginal people had no elaborate instruments to detect the solstice, but they were able to notice a slight elevation of the sun's path within a few days after the solstice, perhaps by December 25th. Celebrations were often timed for about the 25th. December includes celebrations in many faiths and locations, ancient and modern. Here's a sampling of those. And by the way, in case you have not heard these abbreviations before, they're the modern archaeological and anthropological terms. BCE is Before Common Era, and CE is Common Era, and these have replaced the BC and AD that we used to use. So let's start in prehistoric Europe. Many remains of ancient stone structures can be found in Europe. Some date back many millennia BCE. Some appear to have religious or astronomical purposes. One example is in the Orkney Islands of Scotland, Mayshoe. There is a chambered cairn built on a leveled area with a surrounding bank and ditch. It has been carbon dated at 2750 BCE. Inside the cairn is a stone structure with a long entry tunnel. The structure is aligned so that sunlight can shine along the entry passage into the interior of the megalith and illuminate the back of the structure. This happens only at sunrise at the winter solstice. One of the most impressive prehistoric monuments in Europe is at Newgrange in County Meath in eastern Ireland. It covers an area of 1 acre and has an entrance passage that is almost 60 feet long. Above the entranceway is a stone box that allows the light from the sun to penetrate to the back of the cairn at sunrise on the winter solstice. It has been dated at about 3300 BCE. It is one of the oldest structures in the world. Going to ancient Ireland, Druid and Druidesses formed the professional class in ancient Celtic society. They performed the functions of modern-day priests, teachers, ambassadors, astronomers, genealogists, philosophers, musicians, theologians, etc. Druids led all public rituals, which were normally held within groves of sacred trees. They considered this the time the sun god journeyed through the underworld to learn the secrets of death and life and bring out souls to be reincarnated. Native American spirituality also observed solstices. The Pueblo tribe observed both summer and winter solstices, although the specific details of the rituals differ from Pueblo to Pueblo. The rites are built around the sun, the coming new year, and the rebirth of vegetation in the spring. The Hopi tribe was dedicated to giving aid and direction to the sun, which is ready to return and give strength to budding life. Their ceremony is called soil and lasts for 20 days. There are countless stone structures created by Native Americans in the past to detect the solstices and equinoxes. In the Inca religion, the ancient Incas celebrated a festival at the time of the winter solstice, the festival of the sun, where the god of the sun is honored. Ceremonies were banned by the Roman Catholic conquistadors in the 16th century as part of their forced conversions of the Inca people to Christianity. However, a local group of Indians in Cusco, Peru, have revived the festival since 1950, and it is now a major festival in Cusco. Returning to ancient times, let's go back to the area where our current Christmas festival was born. In ancient Egypt, the god man slash savior Osiris died and was entombed on December 21st. In ancient Greece, The winter solstice ritual was called Linnea, the festival of the wild women. In ancient Rome, Saturnalia began as a feast day for Saturn on December 17th and of Ops on December 19th. By the 3rd century CE, there were many religions and spiritual mysteries being followed within the Roman Empire. Many, if not most, celebrated the birth of their god near the time of the solstice. Emperor Aurelian, 270 to 275 CE, blended a number of pagan solstice celebrations of the nativity of such god men or saviors as Apollo, Dionysus, Helios, Hercules, Mithra, and Osiris into a single festival called the Birthday of the Unconquered Sun on December 25th. At the time, Mithraism and Christianity were very fierce competitors. Looking at Judaism, Jews celebrate an 8-day festival of Hanukkah. It recalls the war fought by the Maccabees in the cause of religious freedom. Antiochus, the king of Syria, conquered Judea in the 2nd century BCE. He terminated worship in the temple and stole the sacred lamp, the menorah, from the altar. At the time of solstice, they rededicated the temple to a pagan deity. Judah, the Maccabee, led a band of rebels and succeeded in retaking Jerusalem. They restored the temple and lit the menorah. It was exactly 3 years after the flame had been extinguished. Although they had found only sufficient consecrated oil to last for 24 hours, the flames burned steadily for 8 days. Modern-day Jews celebrate Hanukkah by lighting one candle for each of the 8 days of the festival. Once a minor festival, it has been growing in importance in recent years, perhaps because of the pressure of Christmas. Christianity. Any record of the date of birth of Yeshua ben Nazareth, later known as Jesus Christ, has been lost. There is sufficient evidence in the Gospels to indicate that Yeshua was actually born in the fall, but this seems to have been unknown to early Christians. By the beginning of the 4th century CE, there was intense interest in choosing a day to celebrate Yeshua's birthday. The Western church leaders selected December 25th because this was already the date recognized throughout the Roman Empire as the birthday of various pagan gods. They had an interest in building on and taking over that date as they converted people from their pagan religions to Christianity. At the time, there was no central Christian authority, so it took centuries before the tradition was universally accepted. Many symbols and practices associated with Christmas are of pagan origin. Holly, ivy, mistletoe, a Yule log, Yule being a pagan name for the solstice, the giving of gifts, decorated evergreen trees, magical reindeer, etc. Polydore Virgil, an early British Christian, said, "Dancing masks, mummeries, stage plays, and other such Christmas disorders now in use with Christians were derived from Roman Saturnalian and Bacchanalian festivals. This should cause all pious Christians eternally to abominate them." In Massachusetts, Puritans unsuccessfully tried to ban Christmas entirely during the 17th century because of its connection to paganism. The English Parliament abolished Christmas in 1647. Some contemporary Christian faith groups do not celebrate Christmas. Included among these is the Worldwide Church of God, before its recent conversion to evangelical Christianity, and Jehovah's Witnesses. The most recent group of people celebrating the solstice are neo-pagans. This is a group of religions which are attempting to recreate the ancient pagan religions. Of these, witchcraft or Wicca is the most common. It is loosely based on ancient Celtic beliefs and practices. Witches recognize 8 seasonal days of celebration, Four are minor Sabbats and occur at the two solstices and the two equinoxes. There are other major Sabbats which happen approximately halfway between the equinox and solstice. The winter solstice Sabbat is called Yule. It is a time for introspection and planning for the future and welcoming back the sun and looking forward to the growing year. Wiccans may celebrate the Sabbat on the evening before the time of the solstice, at sunrise on the morning of the solstice, or at the exact time of the astronomical event. Monotheistic religions, like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, tend to view time as linear. It started with creation. The world as we know it will end at some time in the future. Aboriginal and neo-pagan religions, on the other hand, see time as circular and repetitive, with lunar and solar cycles. Their rituals guarantee the continuity of nature's cycles, which traditional human societies depended on for their sustenance. A lot of this information might come as a surprise to many people listening. You may not have known of Christmas's strong roots in paganism, actually, and that Jesus' birthday is not even seen by the church as happening at this time. This leads us to the subject of the persecutions of pagans. Since circa 395 CE, with the Codex Theodosius, pagans have been persecuted by the Roman Catholic Church as it became the dominant religion. Forced conversions to Christianity through particularly brutal means, as well as Christianizations, which means Christian claiming of pagan property, symbols, and celebrations, are some of the persecutions that pagans have suffered at the hands of the Church. The Inquisition, in particular, targeted witches and those accused of witchcraft with such vehemence that the term witch hunt has become synonymous with both religious and political persecution. Anti-pagan and anti-witchcraft propaganda produced by the Inquisition continues to negatively influence how pagans and witches are perceived by the public today. For instance, although witches or Wiccans, and others who are part of contemporary paganism do not worship or even believe in the devil, and do not engage in any malevolent spiritual activities, false stereotypes about this, which are rooted in Inquisition anti-witch propaganda, persist.
Called your uncle, said we're up here for the holiday. Jane and I were having solstice, now we need a place to stay. And her Christ-loving uncle watched his wife hang Mary on a tree. He watched his son hang candy canes all made with red dye number three. He told his niece it's Christmas Eve, I know our life is not your style. She said Christmas is like solstice and we miss you and it's been a while. So the Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground the best that they were able. Just before the meal was served, hands were held and prayers were said, sending hope for peace on earth to all their gods and goddesses. The food was great, the tree plugged in, the meal had gone without a hitch, till Timmy turned to Amber and said, is it true that you're a witch? His mom jumped up and said, the pies are burning, and she hit the kitchen, and it was Jane who spoke. She said, it's true, your cousin's not a Christian. But we love trees, we love the snow, the friends we have, the world we share, and you find magic from your God, and we find magic everywhere. So the Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground, the best that they were able. Where does magic come from? I think magic's in the learning. Cause now when Christians sit with pagans, only pumpkin pies are burning. When Amber
tried to do the dishes. Her aunt said, really, no, don't bother. Amber's uncle saw how Amber looked like him and like her father. He thought about his brother, how they hadn't spoken in a year. He thought he'd call him up and say, it's Christmas and your daughter's here. He thought of father's sons and brothers, saw his own son tuck his sleeve, saying, can I be a pagan? Dad said, we'll discuss it when they leave. So the Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground, the best that they were able. Lighting trees in darkness, learning new ways from the old, and making sense of history and drawing warmth out of the cold.
Blades of grass, barely
That was The Christians and the Pagans by Dar Williams, followed by We Are One, a piece by Inanna, a Portland, Maine women's drumming group.
You're listening to the Making Waves program. Next, I'm going to read excerpts from a Bill Moyers talk at Riverside Church in New York City on October 4th, 2004. Let me tell you about a revelation I had here just a few weeks ago. We came early for the service and were waiting quietly for the great organ to commence. On an impulse, I reached for the Bible in the pew in front of me. It fell open to the Gospel of Matthew, where the life of Jesus unfolds chapter by chapter. Glancing at the headings, I was reminded of the central event of that brief but intense life, and of great themes of his ministry. There was Jesus being baptized, Jesus tempted in the wilderness, Jesus delivering the Sermon on the Mount, speaking in parables, healing the leper, the blind, the cripple, feeding the hungry, choosing his disciples, turning his face to Jerusalem to be greeted by a cheering multitude. And then, in the 21st chapter, a change. Something I had missed in my many early readings of this story, even in my seminary studies. Jesus became angry. We are told that he, quote, went into the temple and drove out all who were buying and selling in the temple precincts. He upset the tables of the money changers, and he said to them, Scripture says, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers. Jesus, angry. I sat there, thinking about this change in the narrative's tone, in the manner of the man himself, Jesus the healer, Jesus the teacher, Jesus the preacher of forgiveness and love, angry. I realized there is a place for anger in this world. It is important to be reminded that some things are worth getting angry about. And this, too, is something to get mad about. Nothing seems to embarrass the political class in Washington today, not the fact that more children are growing up in poverty in America than in any other industrial nation, not the fact that millions of workers are actually making less money today in real dollars than they did 20 years ago, not the fact that working people are putting in longer and longer hours and still falling behind, not the fact that while we have the most advanced medical care in the world, nearly 44 million Americans, 8 out of 10 of them, in working families, are uninsured and cannot get the basic care they need. Astonishing as it seems, no one in official Washington seems embarrassed by the fact that the gap between rich and poor is greater than it's been in 50 years, the worst inequality among all Western nations. I don't have to tell you that a profound transformation is occurring in America. The balance between wealth and the Commonwealth is being upended, by design, deliberately. We have been subjected to what the Commonwealth Foundation calls, quote, a fanatical drive to dismantle the political institutions, the legal and statutory canons, of the intellectual and cultural frameworks that have shaped public responsibility from social harms arising from the excesses of private power. From land, water, and other natural resources, to media and the broadcast and digital spectrums, to scientific discovery and the medical breakthroughs, and to politics itself, a broad range of the American commons is undergoing a powerful shift towards private and corporate control. It is widely accepted in Washington today that there is nothing wrong with a democracy dominated by the people with money. But of course there is. Franklin Delano Roosevelt warned that a government by money was just as dangerous as a government by mob. Yet today, money has democracy in a stranglehold and is suffocating it. During his brief campaign in 2000, before he was ambushed by the dirty tricks of the religious right in South Carolina and big money from George W. Bush's wealthy elites, John McCain said elections today are nothing less than an, quote, influence-peddling scheme in which both parties compete to stay in office by selling the country to the highest bidder. Time magazine concludes that America now has, quote, government for the few at the expense of the many. What they are doing to middle-class and working Americans and the poor, and to the workings of American democracy, is no laughing matter. It calls for righteous indignation and action, or our democracy will degenerate into a shell of itself in which the privileged and the powerful sustain their own way of life at the expense of others, and the United States becomes another Latin America with a small crust of the rich at the top, governing a nation of serfs. The religious right drowned everyone else out, and they hijacked Jesus, the very Jesus who stood in Nazareth and proclaimed, quote, the Lord has anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. The very Jesus who told 5,000 hungry people that all of you will be fed, not just some of you. the very Jesus who challenged the religious orthodoxy of the day by feeding the hungry on the Sabbath, who offered kindness to the prostitute and hospitality to the outcast, who said the kingdom of heaven belongs to little children, raised the status of women, and treated even the tax collector like a child of God. The very Jesus who drove the money changers from the temple. This Jesus has been hijacked and turned from a champion of the dispossessed into a guardian of the privileged. Hijacked, he was made over into a militarist, hedonist, and lobbyist, sent prowling the halls of Congress in Gucci's, seeking tax breaks and loopholes for the powerful, costly new weapon systems that don't work, and punitive public policies. Let's get Jesus back. The Jesus who inspired a Methodist ship caulker named Edward Rogers to crusade across New England for an 8-hour workday. Let's get back the Jesus who caused Francis William to rise up against the sweatshop. The Jesus who called a young priest named John Ryan to champion child labor laws, unemployment insurance, a minimum wage, and decent housing for the poor, 10 years before the New Deal. The Jesus in whose name Dorothy Day challenged the church to march alongside auto workers in Michigan, fishermen and textile workers in Massachusetts, brewery workers in New York, and marble cutters in Vermont. The Jesus in whose name E.B. McKinney and Owen Whitefield challenged a Mississippi system that kept sharecroppers in servitude and debt. Let us love our country, but let us remember the words of G.K. Chesterton. To say my country, right or wrong, is something no patriot would say except in dire emergency. It is like saying, my mother, drunk or sober. Let us love our neighbor, but let's not allow him to poison our well, from ignorance or intent. Let us love our enemy, even as we resist his aggression. We cannot defeat the terrorists if we become like them. We cannot stand up to the religious right if we imitate them.
Thanks to Steve Diamond for those words from Bill Moyers. Please give us feedback. Our email address is nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com. And we hope to see you next week, January 1st, 2 to 4, for our first show of 2005, where we will be focusing on the environment.